Funding for this podcast comes from MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink software, accelerating the pace of engineering and science. Learn more at MathWorks.com.
Early last Thursday, Mary Jane Fenech did what she does every morning. She checked Facebook, but it seemed kind of different.
Suddenly, you could see more content from family and friends. But then when I switched on the news, and that's all they would, it was like 6:30 in the morning, and everyone was talking about Facebook.
Well, the news was the total lack of news on Facebook. Mary Jane works for the Australian Broadcasting Company in Melbourne, so she checked ABC Melbourne's Facebook page.
And to see all of our content had disappeared was actually quite shocking. And I stood there for a little while in my bathroom going, oh, this changes so much for us.
You see, last week, the Australian government was close to passing a new law that would have required Facebook to pay for news content that appeared on the platform. Facebook responded by blocking news from the feeds of 13 million Australians, a reluctant move, according to Facebook Vice President of Public Policy Simon Milner.
We'd like to have, continue to work with the government to achieve a fair and stable law which enables people to share news on Facebook in the way that they've been doing before. But the law as it stands fundamentally misunderstands the way that news works on Facebook.
But it wasn't just news that disappeared from Australian Facebook.
The Bureau of Meteorology, their site was taken down. Hospital sites were taken down. I believe the Royal Children's Hospital in Melbourne was taken down. Non-for-profit Indigenous organisations, community radio stations were impacted. It wasn't just the big news organisations that were impacted.
Mary Jane is an engagement producer at ABC. Getting people to see Australian news on social media is her entire job.
We go where the audience is. So if the audience is on Facebook, then we'll share our content on Facebook.
And in fact, the audience is on Facebook. For example, here in the United States, more than a third of American adults say they use Facebook to get their news. More than half say their news, they find that on basically all of social media. That's according to the Pew Research Center. The trends are similar in Australia, which is why Mary Jane says Facebook is a critical tool to spread trustworthy information.
In the middle of a pandemic, and you were trying to get people accurate, factual information on very serious things, you know, things that will get us out of a pandemic. And when that is no longer available on one of the biggest social media sites, what fills that void? Misinformation. And that worries me.
And by the way, that is exactly what happened when Facebook turned off the news in Australia. False information filled Australian feeds. Well, I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. This is On Point, and that was Mary Jane Fenech from the Australian Broadcasting Company in Melbourne. On Tuesday, though, Facebook and the Australian government announced that they're working out a deal, and the news will be restored, quote, in the coming days, according to Facebook. But the standoff is indicative of a fundamental clash of powers and interests in the modern world, and so global regulators are watching. Who should control the flow of news and information? Should a billionaire in Menlo Park, California, have that much power to determine what Mary Jane Fenech sees in Melbourne, Australia? And how do we keep the internet open and information accessible? Who should have to pay? That's what we're going to tackle today. And we're going to start with Elizabeth Dwoskin. She's Silicon Valley reporter for The Washington Post. She joins us from Oakland, California. Liza, welcome to the show.
Thank you.
So first of all, okay, tell us, we're going to go back to the beginning of the story in a second, but what do we know at this moment about the nature of the deal that Facebook has struck with the Australian government?
Well, at this moment, it's a little bit vague, but basically the Australian government has agreed to essentially amend this proposed law. And the amendments would basically take out what Facebook thought was the worst part of the deal, which was this arbitration clause, which essentially said that, you know, the social platforms and these media conglomerates, and and companies should negotiate their rates for how much the tech platforms are going to pay them for their content. But if it doesn't work out, they have to go to this arbitration and the government will set the rate. And that, Facebook said, no, nobody's messing in my business like that. And that's what caused the standoff. That's what caused them to pull the plug on news for the whole country. And now they say that that clause is still there, but there's a lot more flexibility so that it's only a last resort.
Okay. So
that's how I parse it.
Okay.
There's been a lot of legalese right now.
Yeah. And it's definitely still a developing story. So we'll continue to dig into that. But so let's go back a little. I mean, it's not an exaggeration to say that when Facebook last week decided to block news content from its feeds in Australia, that, you know, we heard Mary Jane there from the Australian Broadcasting Company say that, like, their entire Facebook page for ABC Melbourne was just, like, blank. Is that what happened across the country?
It was blank for thousands of pages, and not just the news pages. You may have heard that Facebook took a very liberal interpretation of news. A lot of people think that was just kind of sticking it to the Australian government, which is that they just deleted any page, blocked any page that had to do with what they thought was newsworthy. So we're talking about, this is the week of Australia's rollout for vaccines, and they made all the public health pages on Facebook blank. They made fire rescue pages. It's also Australia's fire season. And you think about how much Facebook is often used for people saying, hey, I'm here during a disaster or I need help. Those pages went blank. Pages for survivors of sexual assault and groups like that went blank. Groups targeting misinformation, like nonprofits, went blank. So there were thousands of charities that were also swept up. Later said Facebook said, quote unquote, that was a mistake. But if you read between the lines, it's not very hard to see that they were saying the laws were written so broadly that we're just going to do everything and kind of show our might, flex. We were going to flex.
Wow. And did they ever? Now, this law, which hasn't yet fully passed, as you said, in Australia, is called the News Media and Digital Platforms Mandatory Bargaining Code. I mean, it's been under consideration for quite some time. So what caused Facebook to take this drastic action last week?
It's been under consideration, actually, for 3 years, since 2017, some version of it. But then over the summer, I want to say in August, that's when it got more serious because the government released a draft of the law so they could see it in writing. And that's when negotiations really started in earnest, not just between Facebook, but also between Google, particularly Google, the other big tech platform involved in this. And, Google and Facebook both said at the time, and people thought they were just bluffing, but they said, well, we're going to have to, if this law is really bad, we're going to have to, just stop news service in Australia. And, everyone thought it was a bluff. And in fact, Google took a more conciliatory path, whereas Google negotiated the rates. Those rates were favorable to publishers. The other element of this is that another big player in this, you may have heard, is Rupert Murdoch. He owns News Corp in the United States, which owns Fox and the Wall Street Journal. But in Australia, he controls, I think it's something like, I've read roughly 70% of the newspaper print market.
Mm-hmm.
So he's an enormous player, and he has been very strident for years saying that basically social platforms and tech platforms are undermining the business model of journalism. And on some level, we know that that's absolutely true. We're journalists here. We've seen the disruption in our industry. And so Murdoch, who has incredible political power in Australia, is negotiating around the clock with Google, with Facebook, with the Australian government. This is happening for several months. Google comes up with a compromise. Facebook also continues negotiating. Mark Zuckerberg, the CEO, gets involved. He even talks to Robert Thompson, the head of News Corp. He's talking personally to Australian government officials. But in the end, they didn't come up with an agreement that Facebook found favorable. And what I think is super interesting is that they went really aggressive on them. This is a time when, we could talk about it. Facebook's under a lot of scrutiny, and they claim they were backed into a corner and they, quote, had to do this. But we know this is a huge show of might. They didn't have to. Google took a different route.
It's hard to imagine that a company that hosts more than 2 billion monthly users, it can be backed into any kind of corner. I wonder what corner is big enough to back Facebook into.
Exactly. But, what kind of corner? They can't fit a corner.
You know, so you're to your point, though. Okay, so this is we're going to get into the Murdoch part of this story a little bit later because it's really interesting. I mean, it's like almost a battle of the billionaires in terms of who controls news and information and then the flow of information. Around the world and the whole all of the rest of us being not just the news business, but people, everyday people are kind of trapped in between. But the 2 billion plus Facebook users, I mean, Australia is kind of a small little drip in that very large ocean, right?
Like 17 million user drip.
So why is it that Facebook put so much effort, I mean, to the point of Mark Zuckerberg being personally involved in negotiations with the Australian government? Or
right.
the news companies and Australia, I should say.
Exactly. So this is, as you said, it's a 17, we're talking about a small country of 17 million users for Facebook. It's a drop in the bucket of their user base. But I think that the reason that they acted this way is a mix of the personalities who've been involved in making this decision and the tone that Facebook wants to set strategically going forward. So we could take it into two parts. The tone part of it is that this is a company that is under assault all over the world right now, in Europe, where they're facing new regulations, in the United States, where they're facing not only a landmark antitrust case from the U.S. Department of Justice, but also hearing Zuckerberg's going to appear before Congress next month in congressional hearings, and a Democratic Congress that wants to do something about regulating social media, which is totally unregulated in the U.S. And you have this moment where, you know, my thinking is, well, they're probably just going to behind the scenes try to find compromises to these things, the way that they have gone out and said, we support these internet regulations in the United States, but we know behind the scenes they're trying to shape them to their liking. So I was super surprised to see that strategically the tact that they're choosing is to go on the offense against their critics and take a position. And it's not just Australia. If you look at what Facebook is doing right now with Apple and Tim Cook, mm-hmm. they're setting up a whole battle against Apple where Mark Zuckerberg is using many high-profile chances he gets personally to go after Apple. And
Liz, I'm gonna just jump in here for just a quick second because we have to take a quick break. We'll come back from the other side of that break and I'll let you finish your thought there. So we're talking about Facebook v. Australia. We'll be back. This is On Point.
Support for the On Point podcast comes from Indeed. If you need to hire, you need Indeed. Indeed is your matching and hiring platform that lets you find candidates fast. Ditch the busy work and use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with candidates faster. And listeners get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/onpoint. That's Indeed.com/onpoint. Terms and conditions apply. Need to hire? You need Indeed.
This is On Point. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. In this hour, we are talking about how Facebook basically turned off the news in Australia in terms of news content that appeared in Australian Facebook feeds over a dispute regarding a proposed law that the Australian government is taking a look at that would force tech platforms to pay for news content that appears on their sites. And I'm speaking today with Liza Dwoskin. She is Silicon Valley correspondent for The Washington Post with us from Oakland, California. And Liza, I had to interrupt you there just to take that quick break. You were talking to us about your surprise that Facebook is taking such a publicly aggressive posture, not just in Australia, but you were saying even here in the United States vis-a-vis Apple. What does that tell you about how Facebook is seeing, you know, its business and its immediate future right now globally?
Well, I think this is telling you that this is a company that sees itself as incredibly under threat and that the response that they're going to take is to go on the offense. As I said, they're also attacking Tim Cook. They're doing this big campaign around internet regulations around the world. They took this brazen action in Australia. And I think my understanding of it is it has to do with the personalities involved. You know, Mark Zuckerberg is someone who, if he feels threatened, he's going to double down and attack even further. And what we're learning as well is that Nick Clegg, who's his head of policy, his number two, who is the former deputy prime minister of the UK, he's someone who's shaping that messaging. He was recently hired, and we haven't quite understood what his role is going to be. And now we see he's also someone who does not want to go down without a fight. He sent out an email today saying that this whole thing was a, quote, shakedown, that they were calling it a shakedown from Australian media conglomerates like Murdoch. Like, he uses words like, this was a shakedown. This was, so you can see that they're going to use really strong language to express their position. And that's kind of new for Facebook, actually.
Wait, so Liz, he sent out, was that an internal Facebook email that Clegg sent out or a public one?
That was a public one, okay. Actually, right before. Yeah, I think he tweeted it too, right before I got on the show. I saw he's going further.
Okay. Interesting. So on the one hand, they're saying it was a shakedown by Rupert Murdoch. But on the other hand, Nick Clegg was also saying they erred on the side of over-enforcement and turning off the news. Absolutely fascinating. But Liza Dwoskin, Silicon Valley correspondent at The Washington Post, thank you so much for joining us today.
Thanks for having me.
All right. Well, let's listen to a little bit from someone who actually worked at Facebook in Australia, Stephen Sheeler. He's the former Facebook CEO for Australia and New Zealand. He left the post in 2017. We talked to him, and he said there are three crucial things to understand about what Facebook was doing in Australia.
Facebook has said, we're going to undermine a government if we feel they're doing something we don't like. Number two, they've said, and this is financially inconsequential to us. And then three is, and you can't actually vote for or against our action. If you take those three things together, that's a huge problem for every government around the world. And it's not because Facebook is necessarily a bad company. It's just that this kind of power shouldn't be seated in an individual company. This is kind of the kind of power that voters should have a say over.
And from his time working at Facebook, Sheeler says he sees a lack of accountability coming right from the top, beginning with Mark Zuckerberg.
I think there is a degree of Mark think within Facebook. Remember, he controls Facebook. He can't be fired by his own board. So there's nobody that Mark's accountable to. And I think we all need to be accountable to somebody. But I think that cascades through the organization. So you see a lack of accountability across Facebook. Look at the scandals we've had with Cambridge Analytica or with the Christchurch killings a couple of years ago here in this part of the world. Nobody has lost their job at Facebook, least of all Mark.
Sheeler there is referring to the shootings that happened in two mosques in Christchurch, New Zealand in 2019. Now, he hopes to see a unified international approach to legislation that reins in the tech giant's powers. But barring that, Sheeler predicts that a, quote, blanket of smog could hinder global democracies.
And that blanket of smog is going to be misinformation, hollowing out of journalism, a lack of accurate facts that we all can agree on. And I think in that world, the fix is not going to be from fixing Facebook and Google. It's going to be from fixing democracy. And I think we need to turn to our own democratic institutions to say, are they robust enough?
That was Stephen Sheeler, former CEO of Facebook for Australia and New Zealand. He spoke with us from Sydney. Well, joining us now is Elizabeth Rainieris, founding director of the Notre Dame IBM Technology Ethics Lab. She's also a human rights fellow at Harvard's Carr Center and a fellow at Stanford's Digital Civil Society Lab. Elizabeth, welcome to On Point.
Hi, Meghna. It's great to be here.
So give us your big take here. What really is at stake in this sort of almost opening salvo between Facebook and the sovereign government of the nation of Australia?
So what's been really interesting in all this is how often Facebook has repeated the mantra that the law in Australia fundamentally misunderstands the relationship between platforms and news publishers. But I think what's really at stake here is that Facebook, and particularly Mark Zuckerberg, fundamentally misunderstand the relationship between large corporations and sovereign nation states like Australia. To me, this story is really about a private company negotiating against a democratically elected government and about the power of a single company to, in one fell swoop, deny an entire nation access to information, particularly as noted before, in the middle of a pandemic. And it's about how to hold a large monopolistic company like Facebook accountable to democratic processes
Make the case for your argument, because you know you could say that it's just sort of the 21st century version of something that's been going on a long time in terms of corporate influence in lawmaking in democracies around the world. I mean, you know, here in the United States, we've got corporations that get together and basically write legislation and put it in front of lawmakers, and they sometimes just rubber stamp it. So what's discernible or significantly different about what's happening with Facebook in Australia?
That's absolutely right, that there's always been that kind of corporate influence, but there hasn't necessarily been the direct power to have impact in this way. So because of the nature of the products and services of a company like Facebook, because of the sort of inherent dependencies and the network effects and scale of their products and services, these platforms and their services have really become almost a kind of critical infrastructure that unfortunately many of us, governments included, have come to rely upon as we haven't invested and built up our own public infrastructure. But it's also important to note that this isn't even really one company or many companies exerting that kind of political pressure. It really comes down in this case to one single individual who acts as both CEO and chairman of the board at Facebook.
Right. Mark Zuckerberg, as we've noted before, because he does have also voting control of his own board. He can't even be fired by his own board as CEO, which is kind of amazing. But I do have to ask you, I mean, Elizabeth, the overall idea here with this proposed legislation in Australia, on the one hand, it kind of makes sense, like this idea that the concept that social media platforms and their hosting of content or how they share news content has been very detrimental to the financial well-being of journalism organizations. Totally understand that. But we're also still talking about, private companies and in the case of some news organizations, private news organizations, right? We haven't yet reached the point where a company like Facebook, even though to you're saying it's like critical infrastructure, we're not yet regulating it like a public good. So what business does a government have at all being in the middle of transactions or business relationships between two essentially private companies, the news and social media platforms?
I think this is an instance of or an example of, a law with a lot of problems, or a draft law with a lot of problems, and also a company that's taken some concerning action. So I think there are certainly a lot of concerns with the proposed bargaining code. I don't think it's the correct vector for addressing the type of monopolistic power and the concerns around reliance upon Facebook's infrastructure. I think there are better regulatory interventions that democratic governments should entertain. At the same time, it doesn't make Facebook's response or actions justified. And I do think it's a wake-up call for governments around the world about just how much power they can exert over what we see and what we experience. And I think this goes very much to the recent article that Shoshana Zuboff authored around the sort of epistemic coup that we're witnessing in real time.
You took the words right out of my mouth. We had Professor Zuboff on the show a couple of weeks ago. And in her New York Times Magazine article, where she wrote about, as you said, the epistemic coup or the control that these companies have over how we know what we know, right? And I think Facebook proved that beyond any doubt when they could just eliminate news content from the feeds of 13 to 17 million Australians at literally the flick of a switch. But, as Liza Dwoskin was telling us earlier, that was Facebook's choice. Google took a slightly different route in trying to negotiate with Australia and some Australian news companies. I mean, is that any better? Is that a preferred way to move forward here, Elizabeth?
I think the problem we're seeing is a lack of consistent policies or application of policies or rules of these platforms. So very much the actions here are very much dependent upon corporate goodwill and who's in charge. And those are not acceptable means of negotiating power in a democratic society. So if there is this level of control over how we know what we know, we need to understand the policies and the rules that apply to making those critical determinations that are impacting on how we know what we know. And so what we've seen with the Australia case is that there really is no consistent application of those rules. And there's little regard for mistakes or collateral damage. So, you know, for Facebook to apply very blunt machine learning and automated tools and sweep up a bunch of non-news content in its news blackout really demonstrates that not only is there no consistent application, but that there's actually quite high cost to taking these types of actions, and that the platform at scale has a lot of problems built into the sort of nature of the products and services.
Okay, so regarding the health of democracies, is Facebook in particular, is it too big in terms of how much information flows through the platform to people? I mean, is the size of it too big to fail, not economically, but in terms of the health and functioning of democracies now?
I think the question of scale is central to this conversation. What we have seen is that Facebook has no good way of doing anything at scale. So it does not effectively moderate content at scale. It does not apply its own policies and rules consistently at scale. It doesn't have any regard really for what are relatively or potentially small micro harms and threats in one context, but at the scale of Facebook become macro systemic risks to our information ecology, which in turn undermines democratic decision-making and accountability. So I absolutely think that Facebook is too big. And the question is, of course, is it too big to fail or is it just too big? And for this, you know, I take a lot of inspiration from Ralph Nader's Unsafe at Any Speed. And I do worry that Facebook has sort of reached a tipping point where, it's bigger than we can hold accountable. At the same time, I do hold out hope that we can, you know, basically use different regulatory levers and combine them in a way where there's still some way to protect democracy.
Okay, well, I'd love to explore a little bit later in the show what that different levers might be. But a few minutes ago, we mentioned another name of a crucially important figure in this story, and that is Rupert Murdoch. As Liza Dwoskin of The Washington Post told us, Rupert Murdoch and News Corp control something like 70% of the news print market in Australia. So I want to dig into a little bit more about how Murdoch plays into this battle between the Australian government and Facebook. And for example, just listen along with me, because former Australian Prime Minister Kevin Rudd spoke before the country's parliament last week about his concerns regarding the Murdoch empire. And he pointed to Fox News's coverage regarding false claims of the election in the United States that then led to the January 6th insurrection.
If we had half an hour, I'd show you one program after another on Fox News which advanced that 100% unadulterated lie. But that's what infuriated the mob. And that's why they then erected a gallows outside the Capitol building and why they tried to lynch or sought to kill leading American politicians. So, applied to Australia, we would say, could never happen here. And right now, you're absolutely right, it wouldn't happen now. But if we asked the question 10 years ago in the United States, could this have ever happened in the United States, the answers would have been equally dismissive.
It's former Australian Prime Minister Kevin Rudd. Well, joining us now is Jeff Jarvis. He's director of the Tau Knight Center for Entrepreneurial Journalism at the City University of New York, author of What Would Google Do? Jeff, welcome to On Point.
Thank you, Magda.
So how would you characterize what the role of News Corp or Rupert Murdoch is in this Facebook in Australia story?
So I've heard a lot of talk on the show so far about large, monopolistic, powerful corporations with individuals at the helm that have an effect on sovereign nations. I'll agree with the characterization, but argue that the focus so far has been wrong. The focus of all that description is News Corp and Rupert Murdoch. He used his political capital and cashed it in to get this protectionist legislation, this shakedown, this bribery passed, that has a profound impact on the structure of the web. Sir Tim Berners-Lee testified before Australian legislators saying that this breaks the web. And in the end, Crikey, a site in Australia this morning, said that 90% of the money from the tech companies is going to go to the big companies. It's going to go to Murdoch. Murdoch wins here in every case. Now, keep in mind that Murdoch himself wanted to be Mark Zuckerberg. He had MySpace. He failed at the internet again and again and again and again. And so now he resorts to, as I say, cashing in his political capital to try to get some money out of the platforms, but more importantly, to hamper those platforms. Let's be honest here. First, this has been called on and off a link tax. It's not a one-for-one link tax, but the legislation is written such that those who link must pay, ergo, it's a tax on links. Second, what Facebook and Google both did is they started, in Google's case, its Showcase for News, in Facebook's its News tab. And these are frankly nothing more than efforts to give backsheesh, bribery money, payoff money, shakedown money to the publishers so they'll stop engaging in the conflict of interest of lobbying the people they should be covering in government to do this. And the truth is that when Zuckerberg dealt with this with Thompson from News Corp about a year ago, he admitted that, frankly, people aren't going to read the News tab. Google, I don't think, thinks anyone's going to read the Showcase. But this is a way that they could give money to the platforms to try to get them to lay off with the politicians who are in Murdoch's pocket.
Okay, so Jeff Jarvis and Elizabeth Rainier, stand by for a second. We have a lot more to discuss when we come back. This is On Point.
Did you kill Marlene Johnson?
I think you're one of the first people to have actually asked.
From WBUR and ZSP Media, this is Beyond All Repair, a new podcast about an unsolved murder that will leave you questioning everything.
Somebody should be in jail for murdering my sister.
A woman who's never been believed.
As long as they think I have done this, then they're not looking for who actually did this.
And that's what makes it a cold case.
No, it's a botched case.
And a search for the truth, once and for all.
Wow, it just gets more interesting.
Beyond All Repair. Listen and follow wherever you get your podcasts.
Be careful. You're digging in a place that's been very peaceful for a while.
Do it anyway. Dig.
This is On Point. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty, and we are talking today about Facebook and Australia and how the platform essentially turned off the news in terms of news content that was appearing on Facebook last week in response to a proposed law in Australia that would force tech companies to, quote unquote, pay or at least help pay for journalism and news that appears on their sites, or at least links or little bits of content. Anyway, there's a lot going on here, and to help us sort through it is Jeff Jarvis, director of the Tau Knight Center for Entrepreneurial Journalism in the City University of New York, and Elizabeth Rainieris is with us as well. She's founding director of the Notre Dame IBM Technology Ethics Lab and a human rights fellow at Harvard's Carr Center. And Elizabeth, before the break, Jeff actually said a lot that I'd love to chew on a little bit with you. First of all, referencing Sir Tim Berners-Lee, you know, one of the inventor of the World Wide Web, saying that that this would break the internet when companies would be forced to pay for content, for news content. First of all, what's your response to that? Would it break the internet?
My response to that is, what breaks the internet is companies like Facebook and Google bringing everything into their walled gardens. It's Facebook and Google acquiring any and all potential competitors. It's the targeted behavioral advertising-based business models that stalk us around the web, that track and follow our every movement, that have harvested our data and exploited our experience online. Those are the things that have broken the internet. And with all due respect to Sir Tim Berners-Lee, you know, he has proposed Solid as a new personal data management solution, which doesn't fundamentally challenge any of those problems that I've pointed out. It in fact asks the individual end user to be responsible for the problem by managing their own data. So While I understand the concerns around what people are describing as a link tax and the implications for the web, firstly, as pointed out earlier, I don't think this is actually a link tax. But secondly, I think we have far bigger concerns in terms of what is contributing to the brokenness of the open web. And I also question, you know, whether it's not been broken for a long time and who it's serving.
Mm. Jeff, do you have a response to that?
Yeah, I want to answer especially this idea of walled gardens. It's hard to imagine more of a walled garden than a newspaper newsroom where there's no transparency and no voices from the outside. Social media and the hashtags Black Lives Matter, Living While Black, and Me Too to bring voices too long not heard in mass media run by people who look like me, old white men, because these things didn't happen to them. So the internet has opened this up in profound ways. Second, this is a case of be careful what you lobby for, because as my friend Aaron Pilhofer at Temple University tweeted this morning, he can imagine a world where Google now is not just linking to news sites and sending traffic to news sites. They were forced in this case to license whole articles and put them in a walled garden on Google. And Google has fought this from the beginning. And Facebook's going to do the same. And so be careful that there may be a lot less traffic going to these publishers. The unintended consequences of these efforts to regulate the platforms, amazingly, has often been, almost always been, to give the platforms more power when the effort was to take it away. The right to be forgotten in Europe has Google deciding what we may remember. The NetzDG hate speech law in Germany has Facebook deciding what is manifestly illegal hate speech. Now, Google and Facebook are in a position where they're going to be the ones deciding which news companies do and do not get their support. So in each case, the regulators have ended up giving the platforms only more power.
Okay, so that's interesting. Elizabeth, what's your take on that? Because, I mean, in truth, we are only talking about a tiny handful of companies, Facebook and Google, really, and we'll throw Twitter in there just for the sake of it. That's not necessarily a level negotiating playing field. If you're sitting across the table from a company that has, you know, 2 billion users, I mean, do you buy Jeff's argument that any kind of economic regulatory structure around content would actually end up just giving them more power?
You know, I certainly agree with some of that in the sense that, for example, a lot of what the platforms have done in terms of bringing things into their walled gardens has been portrayed as efforts to, for example, protect individual privacy. So, for example, Google phasing out, you know, third-party cookies and bringing everything into its own ecosystem is an example of something that's positioned as protecting individual privacy. Of course, doesn't protect your privacy vis-a-vis Google. So I absolutely agree that there is truth to that. And I think the reason for this is because most of the legislation we've seen and most of the proposed, you know, regulatory interventions, frankly, haven't been ambitious enough in terms of rethinking the fundamentals of, you know, the business models of these companies, of the way that we want the digital ecosystem to operate, over the values that we think are important and we need to prioritize in the considerations there. Now, of course, a lot of that is to the point earlier about the corporate influence on shaping laws and policies. So that's obviously an ongoing concern and not unique to the tech industry. However, I think that, you know, again, as I pointed out earlier, there can be a compilation of things that may point to, you know, a better outcome.
Okay, and I will give you a chance to tell us a little bit what you think that compilation might be, but I just have to pursue a couple other lines here first. Jeff, let's just take a step back. I mean, you said that every form of regulation is only giving the platforms more power, and then I presume that's to the harm of everybody else, including the world of journalism. So are you saying that the best path forward is no regulation?
No, I'm not saying that at all. I'm saying the regulation so far has been really bad, especially out of Europe. I was part of a transatlantic working group on content moderation and freedom of expression that was convened by former FCC Commissioner Susan Ness out of the aegis of Penn. And we have a recommendation up online for a regulatory framework, a flexible regulatory framework that tries to leave the freedom of expression involved. What bothers me here is that, again, I go back to the examples of Black Lives Matter and Me Too. there's a racial reformation that's been underway for 400 years in this country, but finally has greater voice thanks to social media, thanks to speech, thanks to the fact that there were people who were not at the table before who suddenly now are at that table. And so when there are efforts to regulate speech, that's what worries me. I'm not, I might sound like a libertarian on this topic. I'm not. I'm a Kamala Harris, Joe Biden Democrat. But I am an American who believes strongly in the value of the First Amendment and the value of speech, and especially at this time when the voices that were always there and were too long not heard in companies run by people like Rupert Murdoch have their voice, let us please be careful about how we judge what we should be doing. I'm finishing a book, I hope, I haven't sold it yet, on the end of the Gutenberg Age. And what it has taught me is to see a very long time frame. It took 150 years after the invention of movable type before we got the newspaper, the modern novel, the essay, a market for printed plays. We don't know what the heck the internet is yet. It is hubris, pure hubris, to think that we should sit down right now and define it for eternity and decide what it can be and what it cannot be. We need to leave space for invention.
But I'm a little confused, Jeff, to be frank, about what the sort of... last year and this year, the new voices that are finally being heard from inside newsrooms and even across the country, and how the internet has helped give, helped elevate those voices. I'm confused about what that has to do with this fundamental question of should platforms like Facebook be asked at all in any way, shape, or form to pay for the journalism that appears on their platform?
If you want to go tax Facebook and Google, fine. But who is to say that entitled hedge funds owning newspaper companies and owners like Rupert Murdoch should get that money? If you want more tax revenue from the platforms, fine. I would say give it to internet access for the poor. Give it to education. Give it to healthcare. There's a lot of needs in the society greater than Rupert Murdoch's. So I think it's really important to recognize that there isn't a one-for-one here. God did not give these newspapers the revenue they had and the audience they had. Facebook was not built for news. Our readers took news there to discuss it. Twitter was not built for news. Our readers and witnesses took news there. Google was not built for news. Krishna Bharat built Google News because we didn't provide a view of the ecosystem of news. Our advertisers left for these platforms because we screwed up and kept on trying to charge them monopolistic rates because we used to run monopolies. So this is not a case where the platforms took something that God said should belong to newspaper companies. Those newspaper companies in this country are run entirely by hedge funds. If any money goes to them, it ain't going to go to the journalists. It's going to go in the pockets of the hedge funds.
Well, so, I mean, that makes me see that the two of you are not entirely, you're not talking at cross purposes here, right? I mean, like, essentially, we have we have a fundamental problem of consolidation of power in both the world of journalism and in terms of, the social media platforms here, and that's how we're ending up in a situation, which I take your point,
right, and
Jeff.
The freedom to innovate and to create. I teach social journalism. I teach entrepreneurial journalism. So I'm teaching journalists to question everything we've been and to reinvent it. But to do that, imagine you're in Australia after this passes and certain news sites get some money and they get the links and you want to do a startup. The law as it was written doesn't help you at all. And if Facebook had taken news out of Australia, you never would have been able to compete with Rupert Murdoch. And once again, I know I sound like a Murdoch conspiracy theorist, but he's done this. He was trying to advantage himself not only against the platforms, but also against new competitors.
Okay. So actually, Elizabeth, that gives us the perfect segue to talk about, what you were mentioning. What are these other levers that, if we pulled as democracies that want to be healthy and functioning, retain access to high quality information, not push out the little guys, as Jeff is talking about. What are some of those levers that you've been referring to?
Sure. I do want to respond quickly to comparing Mark Zuckerberg to Murdoch. So with Murdoch, we have consolidation of power in one industry in a small handful of jurisdictions. With Mark Zuckerberg, we have consolidation of power across an infinite array of industries with really no regulation because we can't figure out where to put social media and across the world. So I think that once again, the scale of the problem is very different. And also responding to the fact that, that in recent years, we've seen the elevation of Black Lives Matter and other voices and to the assertion that, that's why that these platforms are responsible for sort of elevating those voices. I mean, in my view, these voices would have been heard a long time ago if we didn't have such concentrated epistemic control. And if we didn't have the proliferation of things like hate speech and harassment that were silencing these voices. So I don't know that that's entirely fair to say. So I think the regulatory, you know, interventions have to address the real underlying, the root causes of what we see as the symptoms that we're seeing. So mis and disinformation, questions around content, hate speech, these things are really symptoms of underlying problems that have to do with things like, you know, fundamental corporate governance challenges. So, for example, the concentration of power within Facebook's board and the duality of Mark as CEO and chairman is a really important one. I think it has to do with certainly with antitrust and competition concerns and the level of market dominance. So we see a lot of interesting laws looking at things like gatekeepers. And similarly, in the Australian proposal, there's a concern about the sort of dominance of particular companies or platforms with such gatekeeping powers. It's going to have to do with consumer protection. It's absolutely going to have to do with data protection and privacy. We still don't have comprehensive federal privacy legislation in the United States. We have seen some effective ways to check Facebook's power, for example, through state laws like the biometric protection law in Illinois, and in protecting us from platforms and companies exploiting our faces. So it's also going to have to look at things, you know, in terms of the content itself, we'll have to look at some reforms there too. But I think the idea is that what we need is really a comprehensive legislative reform package, much like we had one in the Dodd-Frank era, you know, in the wake of Lehman Brothers and the financial crisis, where you're pulling all these different regulatory levers, because to your point earlier about too big to fail, we're dealing with issues of systemic risk. And the only way to address systemic risk is to look at the systemic problems and the fundamental structure of the information ecosystem, and to think about all of these different things working in combination, because no single one of them alone is going to have any meaningful impact.
In fact, tomorrow on the show, we're going to be talking about systems thinking with Zeynep Tufekci. So a little promo for tomorrow's show there. But Jeff, feel free to respond to Elizabeth, but I also wanted to get your take on something else. Underlying this entire conversation has been the presumption that news is a product, right? That content should be paid for. And that it, you know, it's something to be bought and sold and consumed. But Elizabeth said earlier, she actually talked about critical infrastructures and public goods. I mean, shouldn't we be trying also to shift away from the news as a product model and try to come up with a system where it is treated more as a fundamental public good for functioning democracies?
I certainly agree that the idea of news as product is skewed by the Statute of Anne, the first copyright law in 1710. And we've had that metaphor for speech as something you can own and trade since then. And I think it's all wrong. I argue differently, not that news is a public good. I'll get back to that in one second. I argue instead that news, rather than being a product, is a service. That's what we teach in the social journalism program we started at the Newmark School, which starts with understanding communities and their needs and finding ways to help communities meet those needs, and making sure that the communities are the ones who decide when we are of value and successful or not. Instead, what we see in our industry, in my industry, is the proprietors of old media trying to find new ways to pay for their old ways. And that's pretty much all that's happening right now. And they really haven't innovated much. They tried advertising online, but they did a bad job of that at scale. So they're now retreating behind paywalls. Those paywalls mean that journalism is now redlined for the privileged in society who can afford it, which is exactly the wrong thing we could be doing. Meanwhile, at our school, we have a Center for Community Media that tracks Latino and Black media. They should be getting investment. They should be getting support and training. But that's not where the attention goes, because they don't have the lobbying clout that the big old companies have. Mm.
Well, Jeff Jarvis, director of the Tau Knight Center for Entrepreneurial Journalism at the City University of New York and author of What Would Google Do? Great to have you, Jeff. Thank you so very much.
Thank you.
And Elizabeth Reneris, founding director of the Notre Dame IBM Technology Ethics Lab, human rights fellow at Harvard's Carr Center, and a fellow at Stanford's Digital Civil Society Lab. Elizabeth, thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you for having me.
And we've got a lot of comments that have been coming in over social media. We'll wrap up with this one from Damian Williams, who says, the internet may have opened up access, but the algorithms, Google, Facebook, and Twitter, are intentionally opaque. External regulations are necessary, not just a tisk-tisk, and do better. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. This is On Point.